The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Mastering your emotions so you can be a safe space for the feminine is actually, to me, the art of masculinity.
So I would think it means two things to me. One, it's always like in the eye of the beholder. So realize that it's okay to have a different view than somebody else. Two, it's always being created and recreated.
I think it means an openness to growth, an openness to learning, an openness to looking at what is masculinity in me and having curiosity about what parts are serving me and what parts maybe aren't serving me so well anymore.
And so the art of masculinity is truly that. If you can master being a lion and a lamb, you've mastered masculinity.
The art of masculinity to me means knowing how to gracefully dance between both the feminine flow and the structure of the masculine.
This is The Art of Masculinity with your host, Johnny L. Sasser.
Hey everyone, welcome back. In today's episode, we have Dr. John Connolly on with us. He has been conducting training programs for medical, mental health, and life coaches for more than 40 years. He is also the author of Life-Changing Conversations, a book demonstrating that a single conversation can create profound and lasting life improvements. And he is also the creator of Rapid Resolution Therapy, a way that people can process trauma without necessarily going through it, which is a very interesting conversation we get into on this episode. And I'm really, really intrigued by the process of this, especially for all my fellow veterans and first responders who struggle with PTSD. This is something that you guys can look a little more into and see if it may be able to help you. But he has used this not only for PTSD, but also for survivors of sexual violence, which is very interesting as well. And using the rapid resolution therapy, you don't necessarily have to dive back into the trauma, which is another interesting piece of the conversation we have today on the show. So I really recommend that you guys listen to this. If you know anybody struggling with these things, with trauma, with PTSD, or any other issue that is plaguing them, that in their thoughts that they've experienced in their lives, this is something that you guys can maybe look into or even pass along this episode to them so they can, you know, follow up and research Dr. John Connolly and his work. So very amazing episode. So much I learned from it, like I said, from not only just the RRT aspect of how this deals with the brain's comprehension of the trauma, but also the fact that there is a lot more to the conversation of how we handle this and how we can process through it so we can experience happy lives and fulfilling lives. So really enjoyed Dr. John Connolly, his energy, and also his wisdom. And I know you guys will as well. All right, guys, enjoy the episode and I'll see you guys around the corner.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to The Art of Masculinity. Today, we have Dr. John Connolly on here with me. That'll be the last time you hear me say that. He has asked me to call him John, and I will do so moving forward. But John, how are you doing today, sir?
It's a great day, Johnny. I'm excited to get started with you.
I am incredibly excited for this podcast episode for a number of reasons, but your expertise just lends itself to people finding their own happiness in life and kind of eradicating, you know, these negative beliefs and self-talk that we all really have in the back of our minds, some more severe than others. But I love that your work dives into that so we can really help ourselves to be that happiest version. And you're truly doing the groundwork for that with, you know, what you've laid out with your expertise and what you're doing to help people these days. So I just really appreciate that. And I'm looking forward to diving into all this with you.
Thank you, Johnny. I'm excited.
All right. Well, before we start, John, I'm going to run you through what we call the manly round. It's a little rapid fire three question interview that people will get to know you a little differently than maybe before. Are you ready for that?
I don't know. I'm ready to get it.
All right. Your first question is, what is your spirit animal and why?
I guess it would be a dragon. And I like it because he's powerful, dangerous, and magical.
I love that. That's good. Yeah, dragons.
Well, Johnny, I'll confide something in you, as long as you never let anybody know. So I had this gal. You know how people have pet names for each other? And for some reason, she picked that. And she, we were like, I was in love with her, you know? I mean, embarrassingly in love with her. And she'd say, Dragon, hey, Drag. Never called me John, it was always Dragon. And we spent a long time together. And just before the breakup, which was totally her idea, I said to her, honey, I always like it, you know, that you called me Dragon. And we never talked about it. Why? And she said, oh, I saw a cartoon once where there was this ridiculous looking dragon walking around with a pineapple upside down cake, and he tripped and it fell on his head. And that reminded me of you.
What?
So I was thinking, oh, I thought it was because I was powerful, dangerous, scary, and magical. And I was a cartoon character that awkwardly dropped a cake on his own head. So I guess I was seeding the ground, so I was ready when I finally got dumped. But yeah, dragon would be the spirit animal. More information than you asked for, but there you go.
I love your version of the dragon as your spirit animal, not her version of the dragon.
It wasn't what I was hoping for, Johnny.
Oh, man. Okay. That's really good. Thank you for sharing that with us, John.
Well, just don't tell anybody. Keep that one between you and I.
Yeah, no one's going to know about that one. We'll just keep it as the first
there
dragon.
There we go.
All right. Your next question is, what song, whenever you hear it, so imagine you're on a subway surrounded by people. If this song came on, you would have to start singing along out loud with, not just in your head.
Oh, the song that's coming to mind is crazy and inappropriate, but what I'm remembering is a real, real old one called Judy's Turn to Cry. That was by Leslie Gore, and the words were, and now it's Judy's turn to cry because Johnny's come back to me.
So, oh, that's good.
Back when I was like 14, I was probably pretending that one was about me.
I love it. It's so funny how we make an association with the song, especially the lyrics like that. It's, you know, I'll be in the gym. It's really fascinating. I'll be in the gym and I'll listen to something that's like, not like super high tempo, but it'll raise my vibration to want to lift harder and more. And it'll be something that if anybody else heard it, they'd probably just be like, you're listening to this in the gym. My wife's been like, you're listening to this in the gym. And you're like, just resonates, you know?
So if disco is your secret, I won't tell anybody.
it's Celine Dion singing My Heart Will Go On.
There you go.
Your last question is, if you could, you can even travel in time. It's got to be a well-known person. If there's one person that's lived on this planet that's well-known relatively to everybody, who would it be that you would prank?
Oh, wow. I mean, I can probably you.
I'm not that well known.
Because I'm going to get a podcast. I'm going to have you on it. And I'm going to say, well, Johnny, let's get started with these three questions. Come up with something that does to you and does it to me. Yeah, definitely you. You're a well-known guy, and I would figure out some kind of prank for sure.
I've been pranked a lot in my life. I was in the military. That's all we do there.
There you go. the prank shows they have on YouTube are like really some amazing stuff. So that's all lighthearted fun in my book.
Oh yeah, I love it. It's hilarious. You know, if you can land a good prank, it's the best.
Well, there you go.
No hard feelings.
Nope.
Well, that was, you did great. You did great, John. You didn't falter there. So that was a good job.
Nobody warned me about any of that, but that wouldn't have been a good prank if they did, right?
Exactly. Well, it's the best. It's a way that we get to know you, do a little ice breaking, but it's also just, for me, it's just important to have a little fun before you kick off. So
there we go.
Well, you know, you have such a storied background. You have a book coming out, or has it already been released?
There are two books out, Johnny. One is called Life Changing Conversations. And
yes,
that book is demonstrating that somebody's life can dramatically change in a single conversation, in a single meeting. The second book is called Grief Is Not Sacred. And both of them are available right now.
Okay. I thought grief, for some reason, I thought Grief Is Not Sacred what hadn't been released yet.
Oh,
but that is out.
There was a point when it hadn't, but recently it has.
Well, I love that. Yeah. So you have your books, you have a 501c3 organization. You have the Rapid Resolution Therapy that is amazing. And you obviously have your education, and you have created a platform to really sit out and help people in a way that I don't think has been done necessarily before, or is necessarily even being done dramatically now in the same field. And so the first question I have, because I think this is incredibly interesting, is how did you even get started on founding your Institute for Survivors of Sexual Violence, doing rapid resolution therapy, any of these things that you've put into practice nowadays? What was the catalyst to this?
I graduated from college with a degree in history. And I thought, now I better find a job. And I started looking through the want ads, you know, see if they needed any bachelor's level historians. And there were jobs for welders, there were jobs for all kinds of skilled things. Nobody wanted a historian. And I felt, you know, I've just completed 4 years of education. I don't know how to do a damn thing. I'm useless. And I remember I called my grandfather, who I thought was a wise guy. And I said, Granddad, I don't know what the hell I'm supposed to do here. I'm done with college. I need a job. I don't know how to do anything. And he said, what did you do in college? And I said, wrote papers, take tests. He said, you did okay with that? I said, well, I graduated. He said, go to this building and just take tests. Really? Yep. And I did. And I ended up in some place where they do civil service screening. And I took tests for all kinds of things. And then I got a letter saying that I was could go for an interview. I went for an interview, and I found that I had just gotten a job doing something called Child Protective Services, which meant it was my job after an allegation would come in that a child was being abused or neglected. I was supposed to go knock on the door and say, you know, howdy, we have a referral, blah, 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 that you've been touching your teenager's breasts. And I thought we'd come in and, you know, chat about that. Maybe I'd spend a little time alone with her, see what her take is on this. It was the scariest freaking thing I could possibly imagine needing to do.
Yeah.
I almost ran out of gas riding around the block trying to work up the courage. But it certainly put me into, I was in I just got out of college. I didn't know what the hell I'm doing. I'm in a real, to me, it was like a scary town. It was an impoverished environment. And I was getting these referrals and knocking on doors and sharing this kind of allegation. I got real interested in trauma that was happening to children. What could I do with that? And in that situation, it was you get it to be better, or you grab the kid and run, which I did a bunch of that too.
Wow.
After that, I worked in a short-term facility for runaway, throwaway kids, teens, trying to help them get on their feet and figure something out and either get back with their family or know how to adapt in different ways. And so I really got exposed to how, you know, horrible things happen to people at the beginning of my career. And then I became interested in, well, what can I do after something's happened to somebody that's awful, where I can be of some use to that person if that thing has left some kind of a an imprint that continues to disturb, like PTSD does. And I got particularly, I guess, interested, well, in sexual violence. Then when I began doing a bunch of work with the police department, with helping crime victims recall information that would help the police catch the bad guy.
Yeah.
And I began working primarily with people who had been victimized with some kind of sexual assault. And my job was twofold in my mind. I mean, what they wanted was get information so we can get the bad guy. What I wanted mm-hmm. is, yes, let's do that, but also let's leave this person that I just met with in better shape than had I not met with her. I began really looking into what's happening to people who are traumatized, and I didn't like that. And I thought that of all different kinds of traumas, and they're horrible traumas, and you know a lot about wartime PTSD stuff, and yet the stuff about trauma that happens that involves something sexual, at least for the perpetrator, seemed to then have a great complexity in terms mm-hmm. of guilt and shame and embarrassment and feeling soiled and all that kind of stuff. I said, this is a population that I want to be served regardless of any economic ability to pay for it. And that's why I began that organization quite a while back.
Wow. It's a fascinating story, because when you actually started this, I know a little bit of the background was the woman couldn't even recall. It started with a woman who had been raped. She couldn't even recall the rape. Like, she couldn't recall who it was, correct?
She couldn't describe the perpetrator at all. I mean, she didn't know whether he was 17 or 70.
Wow.
And, you know, it's interesting. I was talking about this yesterday because I just got contacted by another police department. And I mean, just yesterday, I was there with this captain and these other officers and talking to the detectives and letting them know about what I did previously and how I'm there to assist them now. I'm real interested in what can I do that would both reduce the ongoing pain or get rid of it. And it was really fun. It was really freaking fun to be involved in that kind of community of police. I grew up, I mean, I was just scared of, you know, as far away as possible from these guys. And then, you know, I kind of got to taste, just to taste the edge of being in that brotherhood, you know, that you've had those experiences. And I said, you know, I'm kind of liking the kind of, I don't know, the esprit de corps, the connection, the part of the team thing with this. And I did that for quite a few years, and then I changed locations. It was over, didn't happen for a long time. And it's just reemerged like yesterday.
Wow.
Where this head of the detective unit says, you're probably going to be hearing a whole lot from us, because they were very excited about how they could use what I know how to do, which is get information that is in people's mind but isn't consciously accessible to come out in ways that would help them to catch bad guys.
Is there like a common theme that you see with that type of trauma, from sexual trauma to like PTSD? Is there a common thread between them? Because I don't know, like PTSD, they don't necessarily forget, right?
Right, and neither do you necessarily forget if it's if it's a sexual trauma. It's just that first one. I mean, that was unusual. I haven't heard anything like it since.
Wow.
And that somebody remembered that it happened and had no idea, couldn't describe it. That was the one and only time that showed up. Then I ended up meeting with lots and lots of other people who had been victimized by the same guy, who continued to become more and more violent. I mean, this gal I met first, mentally screwed up by this thing, but she didn't have broken bones. She wasn't missing teeth. But as I kept seeing people, there were more and more physical, awful things going on. And the head of the task force, when they got him, kindly mentioned my name as helping them to get this guy and get him convicted. And I just weeks ago, Johnny, thought about it again, and I said, wonder what happened to that. And I looked it up and started Google tracing the thing, and found out that fella ended up spending quite a few years in prison after they caught him, and then finally was released from prison, and then got a girlfriend, and then beat her to death. And is now back in prison. And that also made me real interested in, what can I do? I mean, what can I do? So I'm excited that I made that contact, and I'll be able to maybe make a difference there, maybe make a difference and get somebody off the street who would otherwise be really harming people. PTSD, military, this. Let me give you my quick and dirty on what it's about, how it happens, and what to do about it.
Absolutely.
So our minds are much more advanced than the mind of a goat. Humans built London, Los Angeles, and planes to go back and forth. Zebras can't do that. One thing that our minds can do that no other life form can do is store information in a way that we could reminisce. Mm. I don't think any other life form has that. But anyway, so when rabbit is running from a wolf, you don't want him distracted by carrots. The way that happens, I believe, is mind of rabbit causes the data coming in about the wolf to get so big that carrots disappear. When you look up, the sky is blue, there's a white cloud. Where the hell are the stars? Well, you would just explain, well, the stars are fine. You don't see them because sun is coming in big. So I think when there is a highly disturbing situation, our mind protectively does that. It does it for rabbits. It does it for people. It magnifies the info about the disturbing thing. Then that clump of enlarged data for humans is also likely to have some kind of meaning attached to it. Not for other life forms, but humans have minds that then attach meaning. Meaning generally makes things worse when it's about something that's been disturbing. And that blob of data then doesn't pass through and get processed. If you have a colander, you know, you put the spaghetti, pour the water. Think of putting sand in it, and I shake it, and the sand comes out the little holes. But there's blobs of sticky sand, and they don't go through. So I think for all of us, there are blobs of data that didn't get fully processed. So your buddy saw his close friend blown up with a grenade, but that was 7 years ago. You're in his lovely suburban home. Some kid lights a firecracker, it goes off right next to his window, and he's on the floor, rolling under the couch. He comes out and says, "Oh man, Johnny, I'm sorry, but you know what happened to me and that firecracker, I didn't expect it." He's not firecracker phobic, but the firecracker data, the pop, had enough in common with the data about the grenade that hadn't gotten fully processed. So one began buzzing the other, think tuning forks. That kind of thing, I think, is happening to people. That's a dramatic example of it. But let's say, okay, so you like Larry because he's so kind and gentle. You introduce him to your friend Mary, who's immediately guarded, hostile, defensive. And you say, and he leaves, and you say, "Mary, what's up with you? How could you do that to Larry?" She says, "He's evil." Evil. He was incredibly polite considering what a bitch you were. And she says, "I know he's evil." What she doesn't know is Jeffrey, who used to be terrible to her in fifth grade, had a voice structurally similar to Larry's. Oh. Tuning fork, bump, buzz the other. She has the feeling, not the cognitive memory. And that's causing this feeling she thinks of as intuitive, but it's just a problem with other processed material. And in my world, that's what I call normal. I think that's happening to people more often than not. And I think we can solve that. But with the kind of things that happen in battle, so much can take place that is supposed to fully get your attention at the moment. It's like if you're being mugged, there's a there's a knife in your face. You're not thinking about what you had for breakfast or worrying about what's going to be for dinner. And when the cop says, well, tell me about anything that was around, I don't know. Well, tell me about the guy's face. I'll tell you about the knife. Because that's what enlarge. Think of a camera where you focus and bring it in and make it big. And that happens during those traumatic events. And then the meaning gets added. And the mind doesn't know at the deepest level that this thing is no longer in existence. So I might say, think of this soldier who's in the mud. I mean, there's bugs, there's snakes, it's awful. He doesn't lift his head because he doesn't want it blown off. And yet the war is over. And guess what? His side won. We have some good news for this guy. And that's how I see somebody who's been traumatized, whether it's a sexual trauma, whether it's something that happened in a wartime situation. The good news is it's not happening. And the good news is if you're alive, you won. If you're alive after this thing, you won. So hence it's been defeated. And I want to, as quickly as possible, send that memo and get people's minds at all levels to know that this thing is not currently happening. Because even though he intellectually knows, of course it's not, it was 27 years ago, unconscious may very well be processing it as it is happening, it's about to happen, it just happened, all at the same time. All of those are awful. It just happened, it's awful, it's happening, it's awful, it's about to happen, it's awful. I think our mind can be vibrating with all of them. And particularly when anything that has a similarity takes place, which could simply be the thought of it, but it can be happening when nothing is taking place. The good news is we've learned to pinpoint and clear that rather quickly and without it having to be painful.
That's what's fascinating to me, is you have figured out how to pinpoint that. And that, you know, it, when you refer to it that way, it sounds like it's almost like your subconscious is stuck in a loop, right? And it's like, okay, nobody's opened the door.
That piece of data.
Yeah.
That piece of info about the thing doesn't exist.
Right.
But the piece of data about the thing seems to continue to get circulated. And with PTSD, it can have incredible complexity on so many levels. One fellow I worked with, there's a military vehicle, and it's many years back. I think he was a lieutenant, maybe a sergeant, but he said to his guys, you guys stay here, I got to take a piss. And he jumps out, goes over, he's taking a piss and the vehicle's blown up and everybody he just ordered not to leave it is dead. So, you know, how many different ways is that hurting all at once? And so you got to be able to wipe off the meaning. The meaning is, I shouldn't have told my men to stay in the vehicle. Of course you should have. You don't make decisions in retrospect, or you'd always buy a winning lotto number. Of course you should have. you didn't say, hey, you guys stay here so that I can take a piss and watch you get blown up. So of course he should have. So we have to wash away the guilt, wash away the shame, and let his mind know that that thing isn't happening. doesn't mean something awful about him. It's not about to happen. So that that guy who crawled out from under the couch says to you, Johnny, I'm excited. You want to go with me to the celebration? And you say, celebration? He says, yeah, 4th of July, dude. And you go, you want to go to that? And he says, yeah. And you say, would you explain? And he says, explain? What's to explain? Independence, freedom, beautiful colors in the sky, hot dogs, children? And you say, yeah, boom, boom part, remember? And he goes, what fun would it be without that? Well, this thing went through the little holes. It's processed. So that's that. He's not afraid of firecrackers.
That's fascinating.
And it's no longer doing that. The problem I see, Johnny, is that very well-intentioned people looking to assist people that have done valiant things and been traumatized or somehow got traumatized are looking to help. But often, it seems to me, by trying to get the individual to re-experience that painful event in order to work it out, finally. You know, if you're getting raped or if you're in a battlefield situation, you don't have, you're not trying to figure out how to express your feelings. You're trying to figure out how to not be dead.
Yeah.
So of course you're not expressing feelings. And so mental health industry has been thinking, well, the feelings got unexpressed and the solution is to get them expressed. I think, hey, you got raped. If you didn't feel it all, yay, good for you. And I'm, my job is not to get you to feel it now. It's to get that memo, get the good news in. This thing has already been defeated. You're free. And that's not painful. That's good news. And when you successfully get this gal or guy to have received the good news, they're clear. They're free. They're done. And they can sit and talk to you about it without any kind of emotional turmoil being triggered. But most treatment for veterans is based on an old model, which suggests that the only way out of pain is into pain. And and a lot of people either realize that and they don't go, or they go and don't finish, or they go through it and not necessarily. I believe when people go through that kind of treatment, if they get better, it's probably in spite of it. Not because of it. So I'm trying to find ways that are clear, painless, fast, complete, so that people who serve the country, people who were first responders, I've met with people who were there digging, looking for bodies after the 9/11 stuff. All the kind of stuff that happens at war, and then all the people who are traumatized in crime situations. I believe we figured out how to get people better, but it seems to be a very well-kept secret.
I love that you're not pushing them to go back through pain, because I've seen that happen with people before, and it actually has made them worse in some cases.
You have seen it, haven't you? I mean, it's
I've seen people do that, and they've done the process of going through that, and it made them worse on the back end. And then on top of that, they want to throw pharmaceuticals. Yeah, I mean, exactly. You're reliving a very
With treatment, where they're doing two things. I'm going to put you through processes to get you to experience it, by the way, while medicating you to make sure you don't.
Yeah exactly. Yep.
That's both the other together. Part. And the VA is, you know, absolutely. I mean, you got to hand it to them for being generous when it comes to medication.
I mean, yeah,
they
but
give
I mean,
you
at the same time,
four, six, or eight, their ibuprofen, you know, is for horses and bulls.
Yep. Yeah, they do. And unfortunately, though, like I'm not that the pharmacological approach to it is deteriorating the person's mental faculties to actually do that processing system that you're referring to. And so for me, I like obviously they're going hand in hand in a way that's counterproductive to each other. But when you see this,
there's one more. I don't mean to interrupt, but there's one other.
No, you're good.
And that is. So I worked with this wonderful guy, a former Marine who had gone through all kinds of stuff, Johnny, and all kinds of treatment that he said was as, what well, doesn't matter. I mean, he said it was as bad or worse than the stuff, but whatever. Mm. So we got him through this thing and he's better. He can talk to you about it over lunch, the thing that he couldn't even let into his mind. And I said, you know, please help me. Let's get you out there giving talks about how you can get better. You don't have to stay in pain.
Mm-hmm.
And he just froze. And I said, hey, I'm sorry. I don't mean any kind of pressure. You're such a great speaker and you've been through so much and you're finally better from this thing. And he said, oh my God, I so want to help with that. There are so many buddies of mine that continue to suffer. Plus all the people I don't know, I want to get up there and do it. I want to give a talk. I want to make it happen. He said, John, I can't. And I said, why? He says, I have a family. I have children. I have people that depend on me. And in order to continue to be receiving the funding I receive that supports them, I can't get better.
Oh, wow.
My income depends on me continuing to see one of their therapists and so that they can continue to document that there's good reason to continue to fund us. So when you put somebody in a position where you say, and by the way, if you get better, your income is cut.
Mm-hmm.
And all the other stuff, and you got to go through all this pain to get better and feel like it's happening when it's actually not, and all of that. So I think it would be hard to come up with anything that would be less effective than what we have been, what's out there and what's harming the people you know who really served, maybe as a police officer, maybe as a Marine. Right. Maybe as a Navy SEAL, whatever. They don't need more pain in order to not be in pain. It doesn't make sense.
Well, part of this too, which I'm also fascinated in your approach, is that, you know, you teach that notion of self, right? And that is in kind of treating yourself with much more respect. You talk about how to have a conversation with yourself of, you know, the positive things that you can say, as opposed to the negative things we all say to ourselves. And on top of this, I think in a lot of capacity, especially with men, but I think this penetrates both sexes, men and women, but on top of trauma, you have these people also speaking to themselves negatively. That's not helping the situation either. Right? Are you finding that is also something, like with this Marine in particular, were you finding that was also a piece on top of the PTSD that you were having to work with him on?
I think that where I would like it to be addressed is from inside out, so that his mind from inside out fully gets it,
right,
that you are not in danger. Nobody's shooting at you. This thing is not happening. None of this was your fault. And if we can cause that to shift from within, which we can, then the negative self-talk is automatically ended. What I think is going on is most approaches to mental health seem to be what's called cognitive behavioral. They get people really trying to focus on their thoughts. And you know, people who tell you, well, my anxiety, what makes you think you're anxious? Well, my thoughts are racing. I have so many thoughts and bodily symptoms too. But then you can go into therapy with somebody who's looking to cognitively challenge that. And what do they offer you? Thoughts. So now you have thoughts about thoughts. And some of them even have you putting graphs together so you can write out what you're thinking about what you're thinking about what you're thinking. I think yes, it can be on some level useful to be telling people, you know, try to say kind things to yourself instead of nasty things to yourself or whatever. But I would rather that not have to be anything that you're consciously putting any kind of effort into. I mean, when you're doing well, and you are at this moment, and I am, we're doing really well. How much energy are we putting into trying to be kind to ourselves? I'm putting zero.
Yeah.
I'm fully out. I'm fully focused on a fascinating thing that's going on for me in the conversation with you. And when people are going to the mental health industry for treatment, they generally are telling these people to focus in as the solution. But focusing in, I don't think is the solution. I think it's a symptom of emotional disturbance. When you're doing well, when you're skiing down the hill and you're avoiding the trees and you're staying upright and it feels good, are you thinking, why am I here? What have I done? Maybe something my mother said to me earlier, my teacher wasn't fair. No, when do you think about that stuff? When you feel crappy or when you go to therapy? So I think that much of what therapy is doing is finding out the stuff that makes people screwy and telling them it's the solution. And something else I think is that, have you heard anybody in the mental health industry tell you that some of the people they work with don't get better because they're not skilled enough?
No, you would never see that owner. Yeah, you'd never see that ownership.
You hear it. No. People who I train who are using this process, that doesn't mean we're batting a thousand. I'm not batting a thousand. There are some people I haven't been able to get better. And if I wasn't able to get them better, you know what that means to me? I didn't have the skill to get them better. I hope to acquire that skill. I would do what I could to assist them to find somebody who already has it. But that's a very unusual attitude for anybody in mental health to have. It's like, oh, you didn't get better? You didn't really want to.
Yeah.
You were resistant. You weren't ready for change.
Yeah.
How can we blame our failures on the people who we have failed? I think if I fail you, the decent thing to do is to say, Johnny, I'm sorry, I didn't have it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not,
yeah, you don't
you didn't care. You just decided it would be funny to come to my office and pay me regularly so that you could resist me and go away and make me feel bad, you bastard.
That's my prank.
What a crazy thing to think.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It was that kind of ownership is non-existent, not non-existent, I would say, but it's seldomly found because people
seldomly
want to
found there.
Yeah.
I don't think it's seldomly found in every other profession.
Mm-hmm.
I think if a football player is with his coach looking at what happened in the play and saying, okay, I want you to watch it and you tell me what you did there that you wouldn't want to do next time.
Mm-hmm.
That the guy's going to look at it and say, well, coach, he's not going to say, coach, those other players weren't fair with me. it's my teammates. They didn't really want to win. So I think people often take responsibility for their own errors.
Hmm. Fascinating.
But not particularly within that industry.
Mm.
Also not particularly within the educational industry.
Well, so with your rapid resolution therapy, what are you guys specifically focusing on aside from identifying that, pinpointing the problem and then helping that without reliving it, process it and allow it to go through? What are some of the things you guys are working on that's truly changing the lives of these people that is not being shown right now in the mental health
industry?
Excellent
question. Thank you. So is who would I most like to prank, I suppose, but this is one I probably could answer better. All these folks. So people you know are familiar with words like conscious, unconscious, subconscious.
Mm-hmm.
Most people are familiar with that. But you'll find if you start listening, people don't use those words very much. The words they do use are to refer to the part of the mind that's more advanced that we identify with. People use the word I.
Mm-hmm.
And then to refer to the entire rest of them, they say the word self. So you hear, I need to discipline myself. I need to motivate myself. I need to calm myself. I need to whatever. When our minds became more advanced, the primitive stuff had to keep working. So you couldn't say, I'm going to stop doing circulation for a while. I'm busy learning algebra.
Mm-hmm.
So a more advanced component got built on top of the more primitive component, I, self. And these two components of the mind see the world differently and don't know what to make of each other, which is why if you say, everybody knows we are, everybody you say that to says our own worst enemy, right? And everybody mm-hmm. thinks so because they don't have that knowledge that there's I and self simply doesn't understand things in the same way. Hence, mm-hmm. people feel like themselves are their enemies because themselves don't know what the hell they're talking about. And end up doing the opposite. So what do? We have learned to do a process. I came up with a process I call multi-level communication, which is designed as I'm reaching the intellect to also be reaching the rest of the mind. Some communications are primarily to what we'd call the unconscious, some are more to the intellect. And so in a situation where if somebody, when she starts to talk about having been sexually assaulted, starts to shake and is teary, and you say, oh my goodness, what's happening? What are you feeling? And she says, I'm so scared when I talk about this. And you say, am I scaring you in any way? And she says, oh my God, no, Johnny, I'm not scared of you. Well, there's no one else here. I mean, you're talking to me. Yes, but I'm talking about that. Yeah, about that that happened 7 years ago that you already survived.
Yeah.
So what's going on? Her unconscious hasn't gotten the good news. So the solution, find out how the unconscious understands things and give it the memo. And and that's done best from outside by somebody, one, who knows what they're doing, and two, takes responsibility for it. So when somebody comes to me to deal with an issue, if they've seen somebody else in mental health, they've heard, hey, I'm glad you're here, I want to support you, you realize it's up to you to get better. But, you know, this is a good place to do it. This will be your safe place. And I'll be here encouraging you. And I just, what a crock of shit that is. I go to this crusty old barber, a nasty, ugly guy. and I see this new place open, and I look in the window, and it's like gorgeous. And these gals working there are like gorgeous. And I said, you know, I like loyalty, but he won't know. And I go in there, and she comes over and says, hey. And I go, hey, well, come on over and have a seat. And I do. And I'm there, and she smiles at me, and I smile at her, and she takes out scissors. Mom would have called these good scissors. She got these really good scissors. And then she handed me the scissors. And then she came back with this large mirror, you know, handheld mirror.
Yeah.
And I smiled at her, and she smiled at me. And I tried to give the scissors back, but she just kind of stepped away and smiled bright. And I said, so what do we do next here? She said, well, you know, now it's time for you to, like, you know, help yourself. And I said, what kind of help do you want me to be giving myself? And she said, well, you want a haircut? And I said, sweetheart, what will you be doing? And she said, holding the mirror. And I said, oh, I forgot something at home. I'm back to that mean old barber who at least figured it's his job to cut the back of my hair, not my own. So one of the things to expect if you met somebody who trained with me to address an issue that you had is that we would believe it's our responsibility to get you better, not yours.
That's powerful.
And somebody else can get me better than I can get me better, even though I developed this whole thing, because they can see the back of my head better than me. So the responsibility comes with power, and we have power when we have distance and objectivity and skill. That's why it's my responsibility to get him better.
Right.
And I don't remember what the hell your question was, and I probably didn't even answer it and went off.
Yeah, you did. Because I mean, in the sake of what you guys do in respect to rapid resolution therapy, how you guys are addressing these issues differently, it was a perfect answer. And the fact that objectivity does become a powerful tool in all of this. And that's why, you know, you guys hold yourself responsible for doing that. But on top of that,
and that's a powerful tool, isn't it, Johnny? Taking responsibility for something.
For sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
So, and, I mean, with the work you do, if there's a problem, you go, oh, I'm glad you pointed it out. I'm going to address that. That's in my court. Yeah. That's my responsibility. And that gives you more power. Mm-hmm. So when we take responsibility, I think we have power. And that's what I would want for the educational industry. That's what I'd want for the mental health industry, that we take the responsibility to make a difference. I'd like to say just a couple of things about, if people are interested in this process of RRT, I do an open group 5 times a month. One is in the afternoon, but most of them are on Monday evenings at 7 p.m. Eastern time. It's called Solutions. It's open, it's free. Anybody can come and address any kind of issue that they have. And I do my best in that arena to give a perspective that will be useful to folks. Mm. That's the very shallow end of the pool of the rapid resolution program. We have all kinds of other ways to interface with this and benefit. And there are a couple of books that might be interesting that are out there. The Grief Is Not Sacred book and Life-Changing Conversations. Both are there on Amazon. And all of that stuff can be found at rapidresolutiontherapy.com, which probably have in print somewhere, and I'm just blowing my own horn inappropriately.
No, no, this is very appropriate. You beat me to the punch. I was like, oh, we're winding down, and I was going to have you tell us where to be part of your ecosystem.
So
and No, you're
great.
This is
perfect. You have people listening and thirsty and hungry for
100%
for solutions, and I want to make sure they know it's right there. We have people from around the globe now very involved in this process, rapidresolutiontherapy.com, and be so delighted to show people more stuff and open more doors for them.
Absolutely. And everything for everybody listening, we're going to have this in the show notes. So obviously, as always, make sure you go there, check out the website, the books, and everything for John and his team and what he's got going on. Because, you know, especially when it comes to any type of trauma, but specifically a lot of my listeners are former military first responders. And with PTSD in general, I know a lot of men and women out there are looking for a way to get past this. And right now, without being exposed to things like RRT or some other doctors that are going through innovative ways to address PTSD, they feel stuck in the mud and they feel like they're just running in circles. And so this is very powerful as well. I was very happy to have you on the show today. I really appreciate your time, John. I really appreciate your wisdom and your knowledge and also your enthusiasm to get out and actually hold yourself accountable to helping people. That is something that's incredibly special, but really appreciate all of that.
Oh, wow. Now you went and made me feel good, dude. Thank you. It's very, very privileged to be able to make a difference for people who have been of service, for people who have been victimized. It's like, it feels like an honored calling, and I'm grateful every day.
Well, I feel like you're doing a beautiful job doing it. So please continue your work. Please continue writing books that can help people. And just constantly being the face of what it looks like to find that happiness in their lives. Well, before I let you go, John, can I give you one more question?
Uh-oh.
This one's an easier one. Obviously, the show is the Art of Masculinity, and I always love to ask my guests, what does the art of masculinity mean to you?
Kindness and protection.
Beautiful. Beautiful. I love that. Very succinct and definitely true. I love that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Again, I appreciate
Johnny, you. I hope you you have me back. This was an incredible conversation. It felt like it took 5 minutes.
It did. I looked up and I was like, oh crap, I gotta make sure John gets to his day. But no, I absolutely will have you back because I think there's more that we can dive into to truly help people through the podcast and then also continue to steer people towards your program and what you guys are doing over there. So I appreciate your time, John. And to everybody listening, as always, remember to drop the ego and stay humble. Until next time.